daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day to take a look at the great conflict that threatens to paralyze the country. With last week, Mitch McConnell estimating that we may even get to an impeachment vote before Thanksgiving, and then the end of a trial in the U.S. Senate before Christmas. Are we really destined to go through this kind of conflict, this kind of gladiatorial combat in politics for the next several weeks? Well, Kimberly Strassel says it's worse than that. She says unless Americans actually get together and do something about it, we may be stuck with this sort of politics that I think most of us have come to despise. We'll be stuck with it for a long, long time. She is the author of a new book. You, of course, read her every week in the Wall Street Journal. She's a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Her new book, which is already a bestseller, is called Resistance, and then parentheses, At All Costs. And the subtitle tells you where it's coming from in regards to the so-called resistance, how Trump haters are breaking America. Kim Strassel, thanks for joining us and congratulations on the book.
Oh, it is such a joy to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Now, your book basically makes a claim that is going to be controversial. I mean, makes many claims that are going to be controversial, but one in particular, which is that the damage being done by the so-called resistance, by the Trump haters, as you describe them, not just Trump critics, but Trump haters, and you draw that distinction. But your book makes the case that the damage being done to the country and our institutions is permanent, which is exactly the kind of charge that is made against Trump. Where is the permanent damage going to be most costly and most visible?
Well, I do know it is controversial, but I hopefully made the case for it well in the book. But, you know, let me give you an example, because you just started by talking about impeachment. Impeachment is one of the most serious, sober, and enormous tools in the Constitution. And it is true what the Democrats say, that there is nothing that defines exactly how a party must use it. But one of the reasons in the past that we have done things like have a vote on the floor for accountability, and why we've had open hearings, and why we have allowed the accused to call their own witnesses or cross-examine people, is because you need to convince the American people that they can have faith that this is not being used as a partisan political tool. And I think by any measure, if you look out there at just the polls, Democrats have not convinced a majority of Americans that they are doing this in good faith, especially given that they've spent the past 3 years trying to figure out a way to impeach Donald Trump. And when we decide that we're going to use something like impeachment as a partisan political tool rather than as a last resort for a truly corrupt person in office who really has exercised a high crime or a misdemeanor, then you set a new precedent. And as you and I both know, in Washington, once you go low, all they do is go lower. And so I keep telling my liberal friends, for instance, let's say Joe Biden gets elected next year, but let's say Republicans retake the House. Do you really want a situation in which the first thing the Republicans do is launch articles of impeachment against Joe Biden for his quote-unquote corruption in the Ukraine? This is the environment that we're creating.
And by the way, it's not just Joe Biden. There's really, you could find, I'm sure if you look for it, you could find grounds for any potential Democratic candidate who actually won election. The book is called Resistance, At All Costs, How Trump Haters Are Breaking America. How do you distinguish, what is the main distinguishing characteristic between valid Trump critics and Trump haters?
Oh, I think it's an easy distinction. So it's funny, I use that word very purposely, because when the publishers first came to me, they wanted the subhead to read how Trump critics are breaking America. And I said, no, that's not right, because I am a Trump critic on occasion. Most people I know, those who voted for him, They are critics because that's what thinking people do. You look at presidencies and you say, okay, this president did this thing that was good, this president did that thing that was bad, and that all weighs into whether I'm going to vote for them again. The Trump haters are something different. These are people from the moment he was elected, they viewed him as an illegitimate president, an occupying president, and who were committed from that moment to removing him by any means necessary.
And you're talking about people, and you describe it in the book, at that Women's March, where such leading lights of American politics as Ashley Judd and Madonna made it very clear in rather intemperate language how they felt.
Well, exactly. And I think, unfortunately, this category of the resistance, whether they claim that label or not, but under the definition I gave, it unfortunately includes most Democrats in Washington and out in state houses across the country, liberal activist groups, the media, and millions upon millions of Americans.
Okay. Meanwhile, is there, if you were, because I know, and I know because the book is written basically not to just rally the troops, it's written to persuade, that you would like to have some Democrats and independents, people who are not Trump cheerleaders and not all on board the Trump train. You'd like them to read Resistance at All Costs, too. Basically, what should Democrats and critics of the president learn from your book and your analysis that can help them be more effective critics, even political opponents of the president?
Yeah, look, by the way, I absolutely would love them to read this book because, you know, I'm not a Trump cheerleader in any way. What I'm instead trying to point out in the book is ways in which we have taken actions or groups have taken actions out of their loathing for Trump that set dangerous precedents for this country, okay? I don't care what side of the aisle you are on. You should not want an FBI launching a counterintelligence investigation into an active presidential campaign. Okay, that's really bad. Just even think about that statement. You shouldn't want that if you're a Democrat or a Republican. But I guess what they can learn from this is that a lot of the language that is used against Trump, that he's a dictator or an autocrat, that he's destroying the democracy, is overwrought. And what that does is it focuses people on these kind of crazy claims, and it distracts them from areas where they could be making truly legitimate criticisms about policy decisions that might actually persuade the Trump administration to do a better job or a different job in some things. You know, I'm give you an example. Like, imagine right now, if we weren't focused on impeachment, there's a bipartisan majority in the House and in the Senate to pass this trade deal with Mexico. That would be so good for the country. There needs to be some, you know, changes to it and criticism, but no one's focused on it at all because we're too busy talking about whether the president sold out the country to the Ukraine.
Yeah, and again, there are all kinds of other things where the sides agree. We've been talking about an infrastructure bill, which usually is catnip to Democrats. They usually love that kind of thing. And President Trump has been talking about that for quite a while, but everything has become confrontational. And in that regard, I'm just speaking to Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal. Her new book, her new bestseller, is called Resistance at All Costs, and it's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Do you think, in terms of looking back at the emergence of this resistance and of the implacable Trump haters and the destroy at all costs in terms of the Trump administration, do you think it's possible that the president and his team might have responded more effectively than they have to some of these resistance efforts?
Yes, of course. I mean, look, why are we where we are right now? Because, honestly, Donald Trump should never have mentioned Joe Biden in that call. Okay, I mean, is it bad form? Yes. Is it an impeachable offense? No. But, you know, you don't go out knowing that there are people gunning for you and stand in front of the gunfire. You know, you just, you don't give them opportunities to do this stuff.
Well, yeah,
now.
Yeah. And he got on the lawn and asked China to investigate and in public. And I know that Senator Rubio was saying, well, that the president was joking when I think with the day after they had released the whistleblower report, when he said, yes, I want China to investigate what the Bidens were doing. That's kind of asking for trouble, no?
Well, it is. Although, yeah, it is. I think I have a different analysis of why he did that. I mean, it could be that he did it for that reason, just to wind up the press. And by the way, I think people often miss Donald Trump's kind of extremely subtle humor. He does do a lot of stuff like that. You know, it now makes me laugh whenever he tweets out those Trump 2024 signs. And he does it just to needle those who, you know, spent vats of ink writing stories about what if Donald Trump won't peacefully leave office, you know, which is just an absurd idea. But
by the way, you remember people said the same stupid stuff about Obama and they said the same stupid stuff about Clinton. I remember that there were people on talk radio who were peddling this whole idea of the Clinton Y2K conspiracy. Bill and Hillary were going to declare martial law and suspend the election.
But, you know,
it's a sickness in America.
To be better, but they were the ones writing the stories.
right.
In this case, with Trump. But I think he stood down there on the lawn because I think Donald Trump truly doesn't think that there was anything inappropriate about asking about Biden. And I think it was his way of saying, see, not only do I believe it's okay, so I'm not just doing it in secret on a phone, I'm doing it right here in full view.
Your book was written before this entire whistleblower Ukraine letter and Ukraine transcript and phone call, before any of that erupted. Is it too late for President Trump and his team to try to avert this extremely draining and unnecessary national crisis over this attempted impeachment?
I wish I could say yes, Michael, because I like to think of happier times. It would make me happy, but I don't see any possible way. Just the raw politics of this. Look, I fundamentally believe that Nancy Pelosi would still not be in this impeachment proceeding if she had her way.
I think that's right.
She knows that it's not necessarily good for her party. You saw the frustration of Democratic candidates up on the stage this week at their debate when they had to start the conversation with impeachment, and several of them quickly said, you know, we need to be talking about other things, and they're right. And so that was her view. She got pushed into this by activists in her party who pressured her more moderate and freshman members, who in turn got on board, and then she was surrounded and had no choice. But once she stepped on that, this will lead inevitably to an impeachment vote. There is no question. Because for the simple reason that her progressive base would lose its mind if she called it off. And so we're going to go there. She'll probably have to twist at least a few arms in her party to get all the votes she needs. But it's going to happen.
Uh-huh. And then what? I mean, in other words, obviously we have the example of the Clinton impeachment, which actually seemed to benefit the incumbent president. Do you think that that's a possibility here?
So I think it can help Trump. And here's why. Look, why are they doing this? They're doing it because they want to put a stain on his name and because they want to gin up their base, right? Their base has been demanding this pretty much since the moment Trump took office. So they're fulfilling a pledge and hopes that they encourage a lot of people and turn out at the polls. I think what plays against that and potentially negates that is that when I go out and I talk to Americans across the country, even people who were undecided about Trump, who have issues with this president and his demeanor sometimes, his speech, his rhetoric, they are so appalled by these tactics that they feel obligated to go out and vote for him again just to send the message that it's not acceptable.
Yeah, so, and again, that is certainly the clear message of your book. The politics of personal destruction basically is being the equivalent of the politics of scandal. Shouldn't there be a general retreat from special prosecutors and from special investigations and from precisely the kind of thing that got President Trump into trouble with demanding investigations in Ukraine?
We should never have a special prosecutor again.
Amen.
You know, there's such a lack of accountability there. And, you know, to me, and I have a whole chapter on Mueller in the book, Mueller was the supreme example of why we should never have a special prosecutor again. He didn't even fulfill the mandate he was supposed to fulfill. He didn't follow the rules and regulations of the special counsel he didn't do the thing where he was supposed to say, I'm indicting for this or I'm not indicting for this. And he just created a bigger mess by his presence. So we need to get rid of that. But to me, I agree with you. We have to step back from turning everything into a felony and an investigation. You know, we need to get back to a world in which we aren't attempting to throw our opponents in jail or besmirch their character, but figure out a way where there are areas of agreement and people can move forward on policy that helps Americans. I mean, I'm not naive. Politics ain't beanbag. I got that. But this is a particularly ugly form of it, which is increasingly involving weaponizing pieces of government to do bad things. And that's one of the things I warn about in this book.
Okay. The book, again, is called Resistance at All Costs. When you look back at the Nixon impeachment, which is they voted it out of Judiciary Committee. They voted the articles of impeachment out of Judiciary Committee. It was never voted on the House floor. He resigned. But that is held up as an example of the right way of doing things. Do you hold with the argument that the entire Watergate experience on all sides was actually a disaster for the country?
I don't necessarily hold. I mean, look, do we wish it would never have happened? Sure. Whenever you have these moments of sort of national scandal, they're diverting and they cause scars and you have to end up spending a lot of time recovering from them. On the pure question of the impeachment proceedings, though, I mean, I would prefer that that was what we see now. Look, one of the reasons Nixon resigned is because they had done such a good job of showing some of the problems.
Right, and before the House even considered impeachment, they had had that whole Senate committee, which was broadcast. They broadcast 315 hours of that Senate committee, and it had titanic ratings. Some of the broadcasts of the Senate sessions with Sam Ervin and Howard Baker actually played on all four of the major networks at the time. So
look at the transparency there. And in contrast, we are having, I mean, this is an absurd situation we're seeing at the moment. The notion that we would move forward with an impeachment inquiry that nobody, by the way, has voted for on the floor to authorize, which is such a fundamental failing of accountability, and that we're then holding it in the intelligence community, everything done in secret, where people only are leaking parts and pieces that are good for their narrative. It's so problematic. It reminds me of? It took me back to the days a couple of years ago when Devin Nunes sought to provide the country a summary of what was in all the FISA documents he looked at, and he put out his Nunes memo. And then Adam Schiff, a few weeks later, put out a rival contradictory memo.
Alternative facts.
And no one in the country to this day has seen the majority of those documents that were the subject of those competing narratives.
Okay, there's no competing narrative to the current bestseller, Resistance at All Costs. The author, Kimberly Strassel, you can read her every week in the Wall Street Journal. We will be right back with more on our current dilemma and how to escape it here on The Medved Show.
Thank you.
Michael Medved.
All energy in the universe is expressed in motion. All motion is expressed in waves. All waves are curved. So where does the straight lines come from to make the platonic solids?
The Michael Medved Show.
A rather remarkable new book. It's called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. The author is David Brooks, who is the New York Times columnist, who is the author of previous number one New York Times bestsellers. David, congratulations on the book and on the timeliness of this issue. The one
Thank
thing
you,
that
you
I...
Know,
go ahead.
Yeah, I saw a survey recently that Americans are praying as much as they ever did, but they're just praying in groups less. So they're not praying in congregations, they're just praying alone. And that's a sort of a symbol of the individualization and the hyper-individualization of our society.
Which, again, is what we find out about in the book, The Second Mountain. The book is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. I do know that religious institutions have taken a hit just about across the board, but particularly among people who are single, and particularly among people who describe themselves as politically liberal. Why would that be?
Well, I think there is what they call the rise of the nuns. First, people are just not joining institutions, and I think that's a problem because institutions give us our standards of excellence and they bind us together into real communities. And then they're just, I guess, you know, disbelief is just a rising factor. And so I forget the exact numbers, but something like a quarter of Americans now say they don't believe in God, which is higher than it's been for a long time. And we've gone through cycles. And around 1913, there was pretty high atheism. But then human nature doesn't change. People yearn for the transcendent. And I'd say if you yearn for the transcendent, it's really better to do it within a faith. I'm going to read a quote from my book from a mutual friend of ours, David Wolpe, who's a rabbi in Los Angeles. He writes, "Spirituality is an emotion. Religion is an obligation. Spirituality soothes. Religion mobilizes. Spirituality is satisfied with itself. Religion is dissatisfied with the world." And so I think we need institutions to really kick us in the rear sometimes, but to hold us sometimes. And so there's some definition to our spiritual longing.
One of the things that I'm struck by, and I was very pleased to see it, is that you make a case in The Second Mountain that we're looking for purpose. We're looking for love. We're looking for connection in all the wrong places. And part of that, I think, has infected our politics. And it's something, as you write about regularly in the New York Times, don't you think there is almost a spiritual, otherworldly, religious substitute aspect to the current leftist insistence that impeachment is going to be the answer to all problems?
Yeah, it's, you know, I've been around some. I was in Brooklyn recently, and sometimes it feels that among certain people there, like you're in a cult. There are certain beliefs you're allowed to have. There are certain sins that you have to cast out, but it's a cult without mercy. it's sort of an end of days cult that sort of permanent anxiety. And I think this is the problem when you worship self, which our society has done for a long time, at least 50 or 60 years, you end up weakening the bonds between selves, and you leave people naked and alone. And when you leave people naked alone, they do what their evolutionary roots tell them to do. They revert to tribe. And tribe seems like community, but it's really the dark twin of community, because community is based on mutual affection and mutual love for something. Tribe is based on mutual hatred and mutual animosity towards something. So it's always friend-enemy distinctions. It's a scarcity mindset. It's always zero-sum. And so there's all the grace and the mercy of life is drained away by tribalism. And I think we see that in our campuses, and we see that in our politics.
Boy, do we ever. If you look forward, part of the book, and I think what many people will find the most compelling parts of your new book have to do with your personal journey. And you're extremely candid about some of your personal challenges and failings and mistakes. And do you see any hope that increasing numbers of Americans will be able to either come back from those mistakes? Well, first of all, rather than my summarizing it, maybe you can indicate to people how you understood that scaling the first mountain, the mountain of success and some kind of personal achievement, wasn't enough.
Yeah, I sort of fell for the lies of our culture. They're common in our culture. One of them is success can make you feel fulfilled. And I guarantee you that's not true. Second, a lie is the lie of self-sufficiency. I can make myself happy. If I do something all by myself, if I lose 15 pounds, if I get better at yoga, that I can be happy. And when you talk to people who really are happy, they've defeated self-sufficiency. They're utterly dependent on others, and others are utterly dependent on them. They have thick relationships. And there are other lies of the meritocracy, that you earn love, that you have to perform in a certain way. People love you, and therefore you have to hide your real self and put on some performance. And the other lie of the meritocracy is that people who've achieved more are somehow better than others, and that's not true. We all have equal and dignified and infinitely dignified souls. And so I think I just got sucked up into the system and got played by the system. And, you know, I'd achieved success more than I ever thought I would. And I can say that, but what I lost was relationships. And so I had a marriage that ended. My kids left home. And basically, I was just working all the time and realizing that I'd lived by bad values. I'd absorbed bad values. And I wasn't there for people. I wasn't the sort of person people confided in. I wasn't the sort of person people had deep conversations with. It was like I put productivity over people, time over people. And so it all came crashing down about 6-7 years ago. And I was in a valley. I mean, life puts us in valleys sometimes, and sometimes they're not of your causing. My mom died 2 years ago. That was a valley. But sometimes they are sort of your causing. And so I spent 5 or 6 years thinking, how do people and societies get out of valleys?
And the result of that thinking in terms of changing your life?
Well, you've got to change your values. First, you sink deep into yourself, and you don't live out of your ego. You live out of your heart, which is a yearning for fusion with others. And you live out of your soul, which is the yearning for righteousness. And you make your decisions based on that. And the other thing I learned was you can't always climb out of the valley yourself. Somebody has to reach down and grab you. And I fell into a community of kids from D.C. and about 40 kids and about 17 to 22 and about 10 adults. And we have dinner every Thursday and we lay our stuff on the table. And it's a loving, warm, embracing community. And the kids are emotionally transparent. They're really great at relationship. And they taught me how to do relationship well. So that was one lesson. And now I travel around the country looking for people I call weavers, who are the people who bind community together, the people who really, they might be working in a homeless shelter. They might be just doing what neighbors do, invite each other over for dinner. But they're great at relationship. And I see their value systems, which are countercultural to our mainstream value systems. They believe in mutuality. We're all equal. They believe in intimacy, radical hospitality. We don't do things for people. We do things with people. And they see the assets in everybody around them. And those people, I think, point us toward a better cultural system. And in my view, culture changes when a small group of people find a better way to live and the rest of us copy them. And I've met people who have found a better way to live. And I think we're going to copy them. I have total faith in Americans to adapt and figure out.
The Michael Medved Show.
I'm speaking with David Brooks, the author of the new book, The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. David, your book doesn't focus on this, but it's an obvious question. Your other job is as a columnist who not only writes about sociological issues and issues of psychology, but you do write about politics. Has the change in your thinking, the reorientation of your values that you describe in your book, led to changes in your political thinking? In other words, you say very clearly you fell for a lie that said success can make you happy. Success can satisfy you. You say that was a lie. Have you now come to believe that some of what goes about in our political system, what we talk about in our political system, is comprised of lies?
Well, I think I've actually gone back to my roots. You know, my mentor was William F. Buckley, and I worked at National Review, and my hero was Edmund Burke and Alexander Hamilton. And I think Edmund Burke taught us that were really formed by the institutions of our society, and we should really put trust in the traditions and the time-tested truths of our society. He emphasized the power of the moral ecologies we're embedded in and how important it is to be embedded in what he called little platoons. And I find that more true than ever, and that's a central conservative truth. And Alexander Hamilton said America's a land where poor boys and girls can rise and succeed, and government has some role, not a lot, but some role in making that happen. And I think that's more true than ever. And so the foundational philosophical beliefs of conservatism, I think, are more true than ever. I sometimes think the Republican Party has wandered away from the core beliefs of conservatism for something else. But I've really found the books that really guided me into this, I find more valuable than ever. One of my heroes was a guy named Irving Kristol. And, you know, he taught us that culture and ideas are what shape societies. And I think that's more true than ever. One of my goals with my column these days is I think sometimes we're over-politicized and under-moralized. We talk too much about every little poll and survey and not enough about, you know, how to do gratitude well, how to do forgiveness well, and how to do our relationships and how to behave in a moral way. And those are the things that really shape the course of our lives. And you've spent a lot of time writing about culture, too, I presume, for the same reason.
No, entirely. And again, I've come to some of the same conclusions in my life that you describe in the book and that you describe in your own journey. What I'm wondering, and this is not to take this into the reductionist sort of path that every single thing that you talk about as a life lesson or a cultural lesson relates to the election campaign of 2020, but would I be summarizing your attitude accurately to say that you find the prospect of this election season a little bit less than inspiring?
Yeah, I want to feel good about America. I love this country. And I want an election that makes me feel good about America, and that I want to feel good about Americans and the way they make their decisions. And, you know, politically, I very much disagree with the way the Democratic Party is going. I could never vote for somebody who supports the Green New Deal and things like that. But as people, as individuals, some of the Democrats, I think, are really good people. I'm just heartened by, you know, I've known Joe Biden a long time, and what everyone thinks of his politics, he's just a good, solid human being who has a great family, came from a great family, produced a great family, has endured horrible tragedies with grace. And so I just like seeing a guy like that on the stage. I gather he's going to announce. Even Steve Buttigieg, who I don't really know, I met him once and had dinner once, but
Pete Buttigieg.
Radiate decency.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
Pete Buttigieg. You said Steve.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is like Hillary Clinton just criticized President Trump for appointing Steve Forbes to the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. And so yeah. The Clinton is not, the Clinton era was not an era that made you feel, oh, American culture is. It's taking off.
The point was, the punchline was there that he has not appointed Steve Forbes. I think Steve Forbes would be a great appointment. He appointed Steve Moore, who's
right.
Also a friend. But let us go, if we can, to Thomas in Linwood, Washington, who's calling in for David Brooks. Thomas, you're on.
Mr. Brooks, I was just wondering, I relate to a lot of what you're saying. I'm going through kind of a fork in the road experience in my life. But the difference is that I haven't achieved the success that I've been after, have had a lot of adversity and still recognize that my value system's out of place. And so what would your advice be in terms of the first place to start when you're in a position like that?
Yeah, you know, I was with a guy who's 94 recently, and he said, you know, when I look at my life, I realize my life is defined by how I reacted to my moments of greatest adversity. And so some people get broken by those moments, and they turn fearful, and they put a shell around themselves, and they get smaller and resentful. But some people get broken open, and they sort of are willing to see deeply inside themselves. And, you know, moments of adversity, you don't feel great, but at least you feel. And that feeling is touching something deep inside yourself. And so the people I notice who get broken open, they peer deep into themselves, and they really get to the core, like, what do I really care about? What are my values? What will make me happy? And the one thing I distinguish in the book is between happiness and joy. And happiness is when you win a victory, you get a promotion, your team wins the Super Bowl, you enlarge yourself. joy is when you connect with another person, or you feel great in nature, or you worship your God, or you serve some cause. And joy is when the self disappears, when you transcend the self. And joy, happiness is good, but joy is better. And I find that if I try to say, what can I do to that points toward joy, that my life will go in a better direction. And so the only final practical advice I've learned about is be a problem seeker. Somebody said, just go around with that problem seeker mentality. What's a problem here? And do I have any capacity to contribute to the solution? And people who are seized by a problem at least know why they were put on this earth. And that was a lesson that was told to me, and I found it very useful.
Well, speaking of lessons that were told to you, and Thomas, thank you for your call, and I wish you Godspeed on your journey and the fork in the road you're talking about. David, in one of your columns recently, and it was a beautifully written column, and it thrilled me to see you saying it. You were talking about the value of a Sabbath, of taking one day off, where you all of a sudden emphasize the distinction between the important and the urgent, which is similar to the distinction between happiness and joy. Have you begun a practice of a regular Sabbath or Sabbath-like experience as part of your journey?
I've had moments. I've got to get down this book tour. That's a seven-day-a-week thing. But I think I really should. My wife nags me. Reminds me that I really need to do that. There's a beautiful essay by Abraham Joshua Heschel about the Sabbath, and he says, a Sabbath is a palace built in time. And we don't take a Sabbath to give us a break from a real life. We take a Sabbath because it's the peak of life. And the things we think about on a Sabbath are the peak of life. I think that's so deeply true. And I think it's especially necessary with technology. And I have a friend who has this structure of Sabbath, and his structure is, I have no screens for 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, and 1 week a year. And he just banishes screens from his life for that time. And I think that's become particularly necessory. He also has a rule where
his screens how often?
1 hour a day, 1 day a week, 1 week a year.
One entire week a year, I see. Giving up screens as we do? It's a very much part of Jewish tradition, giving up screens. It's 25 hours a week, which I guess would probably equate to almost the same thing as your friend.
Right, and I think that's just a clearing, and it's a resettling, but it's also an elevation, elevating up to a higher form of communication. I mean, one of the problems with communication across screens is it is never out of the heart and soul. It's usually out of the ego, somebody tweeting about how much smarter they are than somebody else.
Or at this wonderful food that I've eaten that I'm posting on Facebook. I'm speaking with David Brooks, The Second Mountain. It's his most personal book so far. And the subtitle is The Quest for a Moral Life.